91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program looks at 21st century issues which confront the public health community. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We present a panel of University of Miami medical experts who address the challenge of worldwide climate change. There may be widespread effects from extreme heat and a spread of insect-borne diseases with temperature rise and extreme weather events. The aim is to improve health outcomes and lessen health inequities. There are also concerns about increased diagnoses of diabetes, as well as coordinating community efforts to combat viruses such as Ebola, dengue, HIV, and rabies in the undeveloped world. Stay tuned. Topical Currents up next after the news.
And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour, we discuss many issues of public health with two University of Miami researchers. First, by phone, we have Professor of Public Health Sciences, Dr. Guillermo Prado.
He directs the University of Miami's Division of Prevention Science and Community Health at the Miller School of Medicine. Welcome to you, Dr.
Welcome,
Prado.
Welcome to you, Willie. I'm sorry, I didn't have any punched up.
Okay, we'll get him.
Here we go. Dr. Willie Prado, welcome to Topical Currents.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, good. Also on our panel is Dr. Lawrence Kalkstein. He's professor and a member of the voluntary faculty at the U of M's Department of Public Health Sciences, Environment and Public Health Division, Miller School of Medicine, and a bioclimatologist.
Wow. He specializes in climate change and its impact on environmental parameters, including human health. Welcome to you, Dr. Kalkstein.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Good to have you both. Dr. Prado, let's begin with you. Could we just get a general overview of public health? It's something that has so much magnitude and so far reaching, as I just learned, but we seem to know so little about it.
Sure, that's right. Absolutely. So, you know, briefly, I'm going to define what public health is. And public health is the science of protecting and improving the health of not only individuals, but also families and communities through the promotion of healthy lifestyles. And hopefully we are all practicing some very good public health practices.
Would you say it's more about the prevention of diseases than management of them?
Absolutely. So in public health, the emphasis is definitely on prevention as opposed to treatment. It's very different than the medical model that we all know very well, where the focus on medicine is really to treat one individual at a time, where the emphasis of public health, rather, is to focus on a population, to focus on families, on communities, and really focus on population-level health.
And what are your research specialties, Dr. Prado?
So my area of research is in adolescent health, and specifically, I focus on preventing different types of risk behaviors among Hispanic adolescents through family-based prevention programs.
And what led you to public health and to focus on substance abuse, sexual risk behaviors, and obesity? What brought you to those areas?
So what brought me to these areas actually is a very personal story. I grew up in a neighborhood where there were a lot of risks. And with the context that I lived in a very poor, low socioeconomic status neighborhood where there was a lot of drug use in the neighborhood. And I was also always really fascinated with why certain youth who lived in those contexts used illicit drugs and consumed alcohol, whereas others did not. So that really got me to investigating that story a little bit. And, you know, really what it was about, it was about that, you know, family can offset some of the risks in the neighborhood that are present in adolescents.
So much of it is educating the families, and there are so many that don't have what you had, which was, I think it was described as a sanctuary.
That's correct.
Now this neighbor was pretty close to home, correct, Doctor?
Absolutely. Yes, it was.
It was in Miami.
It was here in our own Miami, and we have a lot of, a lot of our youth certainly grow up in these communities still.
So now you went to University of Florida, was it?
That's correct. I obtained my Bachelor's of Science in Mathematics at the University of Florida, and then returned back home to Miami, where I obtained my Master's degree in Statistics. And then that's really where I really began to learn about the impact and the reach of public health, which is why I decided to pursue a doctoral degree in public health. And what I really learned about public health was the reach that public health has and how much of the average lifespan that we've seen in the U.S. lengthen over the past really 30 and 40 years has been due to the advances that we've seen in public health. I think oftentimes we all assume that we have greater life expectancy now because of the advances in medicine. And while that is partly true, most of the years that we've gained in life expectancy are attributed to advances in public health.
Well, explain that for us. In what ways?
Sure. So to give you an exact statistic, 25 of the 30 years that we have gained in life expectancy in the past 30 years are attributed to advances in public health. And I can give you what I think are sort of my top five advances in public health, and others may have slightly different ones. But for example, vaccination has really resulted in the eradication of different diseases and has controlled many others. Motor vehicle safety is another one. We often put on seatbelts, hopefully, when we hopped in our cars. We also have safety seats for children, and these efforts have largely contributed to reductions in motor vehicle-related deaths, for example. There have also been tremendous declines in deaths from coronary heart disease and stroke, for example, and these decreases have been attributed to different type of prevention programs, for example, for smoking cessation, which we know is a risk factor for both heart disease and stroke.
Okay, well, let's see. Why don't we bring in Dr. Kalkstein now, and just to get into your view on that, Dr. Kalkstein, I was going to ask you first, what's a bioclimatologist? But before we get to that, what advances have you seen
in your long career
in public health? Advances due to public health?
Sure. In terms of the impact of weather on human health, we've seen a lot. I can give you an example because a lot of it is policy oriented. A lot of our work is on heat and human health. Heat is the leading weather-related killer of all types of illnesses, more than earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes,
really?
Lightning. Heat tops them all. In an average year, 1,500 people in America die of heat. It's highly variable from year to year. When we started this, many, many more people died of heat. Right now, we've developed warning systems, which are broadcast by the National Weather Service and used by stakeholders in the city to lessen the number of deaths. And often there are groups that get together in each city, heat health task forces, which include public health officials and other stakeholders, even police and fire and utility companies. And with their coordination, people have now become more aware of the dangers of heat on human health. And this is a great example. We've seen the steady decline in heat-health relationship in terms of less people dying. It's a great example of how public health can contribute to the well-being there.
You had a very interesting finding that you said that weather variability is more of a factor in deaths from heat than the actual heat.
That's correct. More people die of the heat in Toronto, Canada than they do in Phoenix, Arizona.
Or in Miami, Florida.
Almost no one dies of the heat in Miami.
Is that because they're ill-prepared for it or less prepared for
it? It's more because of the type of weather that we have. In Miami, every day is the same in the summer.
Is it because we build up, not resistance, or immunity, but we get so inured to it?
Well, heat means nothing to us. It's right. We, as humans, respond to the unusual. We don't respond to the average condition. So when things become unusual, that's when problems erupt, at least in terms of heat and health. So you take Toronto, and every summer day, average temperature may be at 80 or 78, and then all of a sudden you get a week where it goes up to 95. That's the killer. Now, if you're here in Miami, every day is basically the same. You know, it's 89, 90 during the summer, overnight lows of 75. The people, the urban structure, the infrastructure, it's all adapted to heat. Almost everyone has air conditioning here. They right. don't have it in Toronto. Phoenix gets up to 106. That's a walk in the park in Phoenix. It's the average temperature. Right. And so those people know how to behave in heat. If it were 106 in New York City, can you imagine what would happen? So it's the unusual and the highly variable weather that affects you.
Is it more variable with climate change? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to get back to Dr. Prado also. Okay. He's still on the line with us. And talk about his research on Hispanic adolescents. I'd like to know how they differ from other adolescent groups, and also to address the obesity and whether that's related to higher diagnoses of diabetes.
Sure. So I can speak a little bit about my work and also tell you why Hispanics are a little bit different than some of our ethnic groups or other ethnic groups. And Hispanics in particular are at increased risk not only of being overweight and being obese relative to some of the other ethnic groups, including African Americans and non-Hispanic whites, but also Hispanics report higher rates of both drug use and unsafe sexual risky behaviors. So what our team has done over the past 10 years is that we've developed a family-based prevention program called Familias Unidas, or United Families in English, that was specifically developed to address these different risks in Hispanic adolescents and improving and preventing these risk behaviors by working with the families. So this particular program is designed to prevent conduct problems, illicit drug use, alcohol and cigarette use, and risky sexual behaviors by improving the functioning in the family, by improving the effective communication between parents and adolescents. And we do this really by empowering the parents and have them communicate better with their adolescents around topics that are oftentimes very difficult and very taboo for Hispanics to speak about, such as issues around drug use and sexual risk behaviors.
It's my understanding that Familias Unidas has expanded to other communities around the world. Will you tell us about that?
Sure, that's correct. So here in South Florida first, we have worked with approximately 40 to 50 of our middle schools and high schools and have had a tremendous impact in these schools. We've seen reductions of cigarette use by over 80% in the families that have participated in our studies. And we've seen reductions in unprotected sexual behavior by 50%. We have also expanded to other areas of the country, including Pennsylvania. And we're also now working in both Chile and in Ecuador and disseminating our program in various communities in both of these countries.
I'd like both of our doctors to address the issue of our universities and medical programs emphasizing public health as much as they should be doing so. Doctor?
Yeah. Well, I think here at our university, they certainly are, and it varies from university to
university.
University
of Miami School of Medicine.
Yes, University of Miami School of Medicine. What is unique here is that there is a broad perspective in terms of how we react in the public health community, and the fact that they've even had me on board as a bioclimatologist tells you this. I am the only bioclimatologist in the United States that's part of a public health program. And I'm very proud of that fact, and I'm even more proud of the fact that the University of Miami and our Department of Public Health Sciences has recognized the need, because two different disciplines are now working together to deal on a problem where you usually had the climatologists on one side and the public health people on the other, not combining their expertise.
So you're the only one in the country?
That is correct. The only one in the country. And I think I wear that as a badge of courage. I really do. I think it's something that's very important that we do.
And Dr. Prado, your views?
I completely concur. And the only thing that I would add to that is that now we're very fortunate to have, as president of the University of Miami, Dr. Julio Frank, who's a world-renowned public health expert. He was the former dean of the Harvard University School of Public Health and the former minister or secretary of health of Mexico, who really led public health reform and healthcare reform in Mexico.
We're going to take a short break on Topical Currents. We're speaking with Dr. Guillermo, or Willie Prado, and Dr. Lawrence Kalkstein from the University of Miami Miller School of Public Health Sciences. I didn't say it right, but we'll say it right when we come back. Stay with us.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman with you. We resume our conversation with University of Miami professors of public health sciences. That's Dr. Willie Prado and also Dr. Lawrence Kalkstein. If you'd like to join in this discussion with a comment or question, that's easy enough. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio at WLRN.org.
And Dr. Prado, I know you don't have all that long to stay with us, so I want to get back to a couple of things with you. You know, as a culture, we seem to focus more on outcomes than, you know, the than prevention. So what are the greatest obstacles that you see to get us to focus on prevention of diseases?
Sure. I think we're moving in the right direction. And, you know, certainly with the passing of the Affordable Health Care Act, and now there's a much stronger emphasis on prevention than there was before. But I think one of our challenges in prevention is that we know, we really have a great idea about what works and what works well to prevent disease. The challenge that we have is that we don't take these prevention programs and take them to scale and really make them available to individuals, to families, and communities. We do this in medicine where we know what works. And if you walk into a physician's office, you're going to be given the best possible treatment and treatment that is based on science and on research. But in prevention, unfortunately, that's oftentimes not the case, where we know what works, but if you oftentimes do not get the very best prevention services that are available.
Well, is preventative medicine even reimbursable by insurance companies at this point?
Well, you know, I was on a conference call not that long ago where we were talking about, you know, how do we get family-based prevention programs for adolescents that have been found to be highly effective, and how do we get them reimbursed, and can we even get them reimbursed?
Right.
And the short answer was that in a lot of states, in most states, actually, we cannot get them reimbursed for. So it's, you know, it's very unfortunate. So I think that's one of our biggest challenges moving forward.
Dr. Kalkstein, what is a bioclimatologist?
Yes, a bioclimatologist is a person that deals with the impact of weather and climate on any living organism. It doesn't have to be specifically with health. If you're dealing with agricultural yields in terms of weather's impact, that's bioclimatology as well. Humans, of course, are our major focus, but insects, larger animals, and plants are all part of bioclimatology. Understanding how variable weather affects their well-being, their reproduction, how many there are, how many we can harvest, and so on.
So in your findings, you also find that, if I interpret this right, that heat can be more deadly than pollutants.
Yes. We have to couch this very carefully,
right?
Because clearly many people die of poor air quality every year. Heat is an acute event. And suddenly you have a very rapid response from heat. That is, a number of deaths very quickly after a heat wave. Within a day or two, you can have a very large number of people dying. What we notice is that in our research, we notice that during heat waves, it isn't the pollution that is killing the people, it is the heat. But that doesn't mean pollution is not important. Over the long run,
right,
people who live in polluted environments clearly get diseases that are going to kill them eventually, certain types of cancers, pulmonary disease, and so on. So one time I mentioned this and the person said, are you telling me that pollution's good for us? I want to make it clear that you know that the way they react is differently. On an acute level, heat is more important, but in the long term, pollution is very important.
Dr. Prado, I understand the Miller School has a new PhD program in prevention, science, and community health.
Yes, that's correct. We're very excited. We launched this PhD program in prevention science just under 6 months ago, and it's really one of the only programs in the country focusing on prevention science. And it's really innovative because it's housed in a medical school, So again, going back to what we were talking about, how medicine is in some ways much more advanced than is public health, this was really innovative for the Miller School to really think about having a PhD program in prevention science. So we're now training a small cohort of what we're sure are going to be the next generation of leaders in this field.
Dr. Prado, could you touch on a little bit on how you balance or juggle the intersection of public health policies with political and economic issues?
So that's a great question. That's an area where I'm not doing a whole lot of work in, and perhaps my colleague can speak more about this. But what I can say related to this issue is that a lot of us, including myself, who are working in public health and who are actively working on trying to find effective interventions and cost-effective interventions, is that we don't sufficiently interact with policymakers so that we can really take these interventions to scale.
How does Familias Unidas work exactly? Do you work directly with doctors who implement the program? How does it work?
So currently, we do have a grant application that's currently under review where we are hoping to have physicians and nurses and nurse assistants deliver the program. Right now, we have school counselors and school social workers deliver the program. And the school counselor or social worker work with a group of 12 to 15 parents during 8 weeks in a group format where all the parents come together. And the facilitator engages the parent in the intervention really to create cohesion among the parents in the group to really develop different types of parenting skills, including how to communicate effectively, how to be more involved in the adolescent's peer world and in the adolescent school world. Then after those parents learn those skills in the groups through these different techniques, through role-playing, through some didactic presentations, then the parents, who are the change agents of the children's behavior, can then have the opportunity to practice some of the skills that they learn in the groups with their own adolescent, with the help of the school counselor, of course, but really placing the parent in the leadership role of the family.
What about for children who don't come from a family with parents?
So family here is, we define family very broadly, and that could be mom or dad, if there's a mom or dad in the family, and if not, we oftentimes have the abuelita or the grandmother or the uncle or some other extended family member playing that mother and father role.
Could be an older brother, I suppose.
Absolutely, and it has been in the past. That's correct.
Well, we have more questions for you, but I understand you have a meeting in about 6 seconds.
Yes, I do.
Well, let us just thank you. Before we take our break, we will say goodbye to Dr. Guillermo Willy Prado. He's the Leonard M. Miller Professor of Public Health Sciences at the UM Miller School of Medicine and Director of the Division of Prevention Science and Community Health. His focus is on the prevention of risky health behaviors associated with the leading causes of morbidity and mortality in adolescents in the Hispanic community. We want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Dr.
Great.
Prado.
Thank you both so much. It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
Well, let's take a short break on our program on Topical Currents. We'll be back with more. And we return to today's Topical Currents. We return with Dr. Lawrence Kalkstein, a voluntary faculty professor at the Miller School of Medicine. We're talking about climate and public health with Dr. Kalkstein. If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. We have some lines open, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org.
So, Dr. Kalkstein, during the break, we were talking about something that I'd asked you about, and we talked about the fact that it's very important and very hard to measure and very uncertain, and how important it is, the variable nature of heat and its effect versus just heat itself.
That is true, and this is one of the most vexing problems, Bonnie, when it comes to climate change. The models generally estimate that there's going to be a gradual warming in temperature. But what they're not as good in doing is to determine, is every day going to be 1 degree warmer? Are only the hot days going to be much warmer and the rest of the days the same? Are only the cool days going to get warmer and the hot days will be the same? The models don't do well there. And unfortunately, for the kind of work we're doing, that's one of the most important questions. Because if every day warms by a couple of degrees, that will not have a real profound effect. It will have some, but not a real profound effect on well-being. But if only the hot days warm 5 degrees, while the average days stay the way they are today, that will have a profound effect. So what we are interested in is how the most extreme weather is going to be changed by climate change. And as I said to you, it's because humans can react to small gradual changes. What we can react well to is if suddenly Miami had a series of 100 degree days, that would be a real calamity because we're not used to it.
Right. So are there efforts being made to start measuring that to a greater extent or determining that?
There have been studies that do this, and we've done some of them ourselves. We've seen that some of the hotter air masses that are around most of the country, air masses being the combination of temperature and humidity and cloud cover. Because remember, we don't just react to temperature. If it's 90 degrees and cloudy versus 90 degrees right. and sunny, it means something. So we look at things. That's what synoptic means, by the way. We are looking at the whole air mass. We do see in many places that the frequency of these hottest air masses are becoming more frequent and that the intensity of those air masses is becoming worse.
Now, the big. What do you mean the intensity?
That is that when they are there, they're hotter than they were before. They're more humid than they were before.
Okay.
But we need to be careful here because what we don't have is the smoking gun that links humans to that. It may very well be that we're going through a climate cycle, a natural climate cycle that's making things warmer.
In carbon emissions?
Well, we know that those emissions are going up, and carbon dioxide has increased in the atmosphere, along with methane and other what we call greenhouse gases. But that in itself is not proof that that is what's causing it. And this is what the big controversy is about. Everyone agrees that the climate is changing. I mean, you have to be a fool to climate's changed for a millennium, you know.
Right.
So the question is, why? Is it all due to humans, the emissions? Is it partially due to humans in a natural cycle? Is it only due to a natural cycle? And that's when the argument begins.
Since weather and climate have always had such a great impact on human health, or health of all living things, why is it a new direction for public health sciences to be integrated with it?
Well, let me just tell you that when I started in this area, almost no one was doing work on weather and health. It was grossly underestimated as a problem. And over the last 40 plus years that I've been doing this work, suddenly everyone realizes that health, weather is a large driver on health. It was a learning curve. And basically, it's something that suddenly has become in vogue. And not only me, but all of my students, my ex-students are working on it now. Scientists all over the world are suddenly doing this. Now, I'm just happy that it happened during my generation, which was fortunate. But it's a matter of fact that in the past, people just didn't consider it to be such a problem. And now we have better data sources. For example, I have data on everyone who has died in the United States, every individual who has died since for the last 30 years. So it's all digital. I mean, 50 years ago, they didn't have these data.
Right.
So I can sort through the data. I can separate by gender, by race, by age, by disease type. Every disease is given a code, and I could look at things so specifically today that as a graduate student, I could only dream about doing. So all of these things contribute to the fact that today, weather and health relationships are more understood. They're collecting mosquito assay data in states now where they never did this before, where they actually trap them and know what their population dynamics are. It's a much easier thing for us to do now.
That's something that kind of surprised me. I'd never considered that. Of Earth's most populous organisms, the insects, what a tremendous effect that can have on public health in regards to temperature.
Absolutely.
And how they proliferate.
Well, there are several things that weather effects in terms of insects. The first is the reproductive cycle. In many insects, the warmer it gets, the more cycles of reproduction you're going to have. So I'll give you one, even though it's not a health one. The one that I worked with on my dissertation was the southern pine beetle. It's a little insect the size of a dot that bores inside pine trees and has cost billions of dollars of damage to the lumber industry. In cool years, there may have been only two or three generations. In warm years, there were four, five, or six of them. And so what you had was suddenly a proliferation of these insects. Now, the insect bored into the tree and the sap of the tree would drive it out. But if you have thousands of them boring into the tree at once, it's like putting 1,000 holes in a tire. I mean, air is going to escape. The insects are going to get in. Its sap is going to escape and it's going to kill the tree, you know. So that's an example. Same thing with mosquitoes or any other
organism.
Are they
reproducing more frequently?
Well, they can based upon the weather. If you have a wet season, it's not only temperature.
Right, right.
If you have a wet season versus a dry season, quite clearly, you're going to have many, many more mosquitoes around in one season than the next. We studied onchocerciasis in Africa, river blindness, and this was transmitted by a black fly. Well, that's affected by weather too, because the larvae feed on little microorganisms in the water. The faster the water rushes by, the more microorganisms they get. The more flies are going to be produced that could lead to the disease. If it's dry or a drought, many less will be reproduced. So we developed a water budget model for the World Health Organization to determine what the chances were of getting onchocerciasis because of this. So
could third world areas be more subject to, say, yellow fever and other insect-borne diseases?
It's
or
amazing.
Malaria.
It's amazing. Insect-borne diseases are something that the third world is more vulnerable to. Heat is something that the developed world is more vulnerable
really?
To. Yes. So
why is that?
Well, if you think about it, it makes sense. Heat is a problem here. The elderly, for example, are very vulnerable. There are many more elderly here than there were in Burkina Faso in Africa. I mean, the average age of death there is 40 years old. So clearly, the vulnerable population to something like heat is much greater here. And a lot of the third world countries are in tropical areas anyway. And as I've said, these climates where the temperatures are fairly equitable are not the ones that are sensitive. So where do we have heat health problems? Europe, developed. America, developed. Australia, South America around Buenos Aires. Maybe the only place which you might consider it undeveloped are the big cities of China, which have highly variable climates as well.
In developed areas, though, you have many people who are too poor to afford air conditioning, so they're subject to the heat.
Exactly. And so it's not only age, but in many of the poverty-stricken areas, especially in the northern U.S., Minneapolis, for example.
Chicago always has people die in the summer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Chicago. If you live down here, virtually everyone has some access to air conditioning nearby, even if you have to step into a 7-Eleven. But up in Minneapolis and places like that, they don't. And you have many, many more heat-related deaths.
I want to ask you much more about what we're talking about, but you shared the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Explain this with lead authors of International Governmental Panel on Climate Change Working Groups.
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you. Now, I don't want you to think that I was like Al Gore, where they flew me to Oslo and gave me a medal around my neck. I want to be very careful about that.
Okay.
Still, it's very exciting.
It was very exciting. What happened is every 5 years, the UN has a group called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's the official climate change organ of the United Nations.
How long has that existed?
Oh, I'd say we were through five IPCC reports, so 25 years at least.
Oh.
It's been a long time. And I've been lead author for two of those cycles. I'm getting too old to be lead author now, but I've been lead author for two of those cycles. One was in 2007. And I was the lead author on the climate and health chapter, how climate and health would be affected by changes in the weather due to climate change. And just my luck, that year, people in Sweden decided to give the Nobel Prize to the lead authors of the IPCC. If I would have done it in 2012, I wouldn't have gotten it. So they did give me, I have a nice sheet commemorating this with my name on it. I did not get hundreds of thousands of dollars in prize money, but it's something I am proud of, and I'm very glad it happened. I'm glad they recognized that work.
Now, you're also listed as a voluntary professor at the University of Miami School of Medicine, which puzzled us for a bit, but then we realized that you work for no pay, but just for the thrill of the research.
Yes, the thrill of victory, you know. But anyway,
agony of defeat.
Well, that happens sometimes too. But I've been a professor since 1973. I started at UCLA, so this tells you how old I am. And I've been paid at it for 30 plus years. I decided to retire in 2002 when our son graduated college and I didn't have to pay for him anymore.
Who's a researcher himself?
He's a professor of climatology at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Yeah, and I'm very proud of him. But anyway, at that particular point, I was going to kind of retire, just work from the home. And then I got connected with the University of Miami, who got wind that I was down here. And before you know it, I'm working with them. Now, I chose not to be paid because I'm not the type to enjoy the type of administrative work that often goes along with professorships, you know, going to faculty meetings and things like that. Now I have no obligation to do that. Yet, I still can use, I work with graduate students, I could do my research, I work with young faculty. We're trying to develop a bioclimate program of more of a larger extent in the department. I want to be part of that. And so it is a thrill of victory in that case.
And it gives you more time to do all the things you do love.
Exactly, exactly. And the credentials. I mean, quite honestly, being aligned with a very good department at a very good medical school is helpful to my research career as well. And so it's a win-win for everyone. And that's why we do it.
If you were starting your career in climatology, if that's the correct term, at this point in your career, what would most interest you? What area would you lean to your interest?
To be quite honest, I don't like the climate change part as much as just the general climate health aspect. The climate change part has become very politicized, as you well know. I am amazed that all of my friends who have no climate knowledge all have very strong opinions as to whether it's a hoax or whether we're going to burn to hell, you know. And I always find that funny, that because they have confirmation bias, they read their sources and get their information. I honestly don't like that. I much prefer working with the data, working with mortality, morbidity data, pollution. For example, you asked a question earlier on, how are pollution and weather acting independently on human health? I find that fascinating. I love to do that kind of work. And now that we have all of the data on people who are sick or dying to work with, plus all the pollution data and all the weather data, it's empirical, and I love sinking my hands into it. So that would be my answer for you.
But we are in the political season. What should listeners feel like when they hear candidates who deny that there's global warming or climate change?
Okay, well, let me just, I'll give you a 2-second spiel on this. I think those who argue that, oh, look, we've had a hot week. See, climate change is going to kill us. Or, oh, we had a cool week. You see, it's a hoax. Because that's the argument today, you know.
Right, exactly.
I hate that. That's not the question. The question is that climate change is uncertain science. We don't know for sure if it's going to happen the way the models say it's going to happen. So the question is, what do we do when we have an uncertain but potential environmental calamity? Do we do nothing till we have more information? That's generally the stand of conservatives. Do we do a little bit? I always use the example of people screwing in those little light bulbs, you know, or you know, having incentives to industry to help them be more green. Some people say that. Or do we do draconian things like put a $2 carbon tax on fuel or punish industry badly if they do not comply? That's often the Democratic stand on all of this. So quite honestly, the way I tell students this is that you need to make a choice. It's one of those three avenues. I don't have the answer because in my mind, it's a matter of opinion, of risk taking as to what you want to do.
And it is a risk.
It is a risk. There's no doubt about it. It's a threat. Do we look at this as insurance? But what if we make our policies too draconian and the economy goes downhill?
Right.
No president wants to preside, no matter what, wants to preside on this. That's why the Kyoto Protocol didn't pass under the Clinton administration when Gore was the vice president. It failed then with Gore as a senator because no one wants to worry about what's going to happen to the economy.
We need to take a short break. When we come back, I have an interesting email I'd like you to respond to. We're talking with Dr. Lawrence Kalkstein, professor and member of the voluntary faculty at U of M's Department of Public Health Sciences in the Miller School of Medicine. We'll be right back.
Hey, And we're back with today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon, 50 minutes past 1 o'clock. We resume our conversation with Dr. Lawrence Kalkstein, the University of Miami School of Medicine. Doctor, let me give out the telephone number. Once again. Well, 800-743-9576, or a little quicker is email, radio@wlrn.org. You said you had an email.
Yeah. Go ahead. Marty says, every time I hear about life expectancy, climate issues, water shortages, extinctions, pandemics, resource shortages, and so on, it all comes down to too many people and the fact that population continues to grow. Every other issue is secondary and fruitless in the long run if we don't control human population. End of story. What's your opinion?
Well, of course, people point out that we reached our first billion people sometime in like the 19th century. And in the next 200 years, we're now at 6-7 billion. So certainly the population has grown very rapidly, and particularly in the developing world. Germany has the lowest birth rate in the world. It's very interesting that the developed countries have very low birth rates. So there is no doubt that population growth is a major driver in terms of some of the problems that we have. Dense populations led to all kinds of issues, from bubonic plague to COP, every kind of disease. So the question is, and I think this is the unanswerable one, how do we curtail that? I mean, China tried. They had the one-child.
They've just taken it off.
They had the one-child policy. The city of Shanghai was starting to shrink. They had problems under that particular situation. So how do you control the birth rates, especially when you consider that it's India, now not so much China, but the developing countries, Philippines and places like this, where the population is growing so rapidly? And I am not a demographic expert, but she's right. But the question is, what do we do about it, and how do we stop it?
I see you're researching how urban structural modifications, urban cool technologies might lessen the impact.
Yeah, this is a kind of the new thing. You were talking about how things expand. Now suddenly, there is on the horizon, and even today, the invention of products that you can put in urban areas that will actually cool them down. For example, they're cheap. You can whiten the roofs of tenement buildings. Think of the buildings in Philadelphia and St. Louis, the black-roofed, red brick tenement buildings. Many of the deaths from heat are in there. You whiten the roofs and you have rapidly increased the reflectivity of solar radiation in the building. And even if you cool the temperature by only 2 or 3 degrees, that may mean the difference between life and death. This sounds stark. We don't care if people are uncomfortable. We just don't want them to get sick or die. Right. The other thing is we're working with an NGO, a non-governmental organization called Tree People in Los Angeles. It's one of the biggest. They want to plant trees all around Los Angeles with the same theory that by planting more trees, you're going to cool the temperature. So this is another way to go. They have reflective asphalt now. So the idea is, and we see evidence of this, you can cool the city down significantly under those circumstances.
We're really bouncing around, but before we go, tell us a little bit more about drought and rain pattern changes.
Yes. Well, there's no doubt that there appears to be a large variety of droughts occurring now in ways that have not occurred before. I have a friend who lives in the Austin, Texas area, and he tells me that the periods between wet and dry, because remember, extremes also deal with precipitation as well, have increased in intensity. You have longer dry periods and longer wet periods. It's not that the world is drying. It's that these extremes are becoming more. I mean, they just had that hurricane in Mexico that was the strongest of all time. It actually hit Texas with enormous rains.
What was it, Patricia?
I don't remember the name of it. It was on the west coast of Mexico.
Yeah.
I think so.
Well, it dropped 14 inches of rain in 24 hours in his particular area. Those are deadly bad things to happen. Again, are they due to climate change or are they due to a cycle? I don't think any expert can tell you for sure. Some might think they can, but I don't think anyone really can. But we have seen these extremes becoming a little more common. Is it because populations are living in areas where they didn't live before?
Right.
You know, Austin has grown from nothing to a multi-million person city. Are they now realizing it? I mean, one of the examples I give to students, you know, there are many more tornadoes today than there were 100 years ago. There are many more spotters of tornadoes today than there are 100 years ago.
Right.
And so have the tornadoes increased, or is it because we're becoming more observant? And that's the question that cannot be answered very clearly.
Tell us in the last minute or so that we have, a couple of minutes, the synoptic climatology. What is that? And I know it's the name of your lab.
Yes. You know, we are against looking at individual weather elements like temperature and humidity and seeing how they react. The real world is a combination of all of these things at once. We are affected by an air mass. And an air mass, like a moist tropical air mass, has a hot temperature, humid conditions, not much cloud cover, light winds. We react to all of this. And so what we have developed is a way to determine every day's air mass. And so really we look for offensive air masses, offensive in terms of whether they kill more people, offensive in terms if they're more polluted, offensive in terms if they cause asthma. We've done a little work on that. Offensive in terms of all kinds of things where we see health responses occurring within certain air masses. Then we can eliminate all the other air masses and concentrate on the ones that we know are the most offensive and dissect them. Maybe, for example, when it comes to heat, you need 3 straight days of hot air masses to cause a problem. 1 or 2 do nothing. People can react well to that, but we need 3. So that's synoptic and synopsis are rather similar, in which you look at the combination of weather elements and their impact.
So you work with NOAA and the National Weather Service.
NOAA and the National Weather Service. National Weather Service is a subset of NOAA. Yes, we work with them. We've developed heat health warning systems for cities all over the world. They're funded by National Weather Service. They've been funded by EPA. They've been funded by utility companies. They've been funded by health departments. So everyone has stake in this, and that's the beauty of it.
Well, I've learned a lot today.
Well, so did I, actually. A lot, and a lot of questions also came from our conversation. Dr. Lawrence Kalkstein, professor, member of the faculty at U of M's Department of Public Health Sciences, Environment and Public Health Division, Miller School of Medicine, and a bioclimatologist. He specializes in climate change and its impact on environmental parameters, including human health. We didn't talk about the gypsy moths and all that, but thank you
so much.
Thank you.
I truly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Our program was produced by Polly Landis, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary, and additional assistance from lead producer Richard Ives. We have free audio archives of the program available for download at our website. That's WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program addresses the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and the recent approved hunt of the Florida black bear. 298 bears were killed over 2 days. There may be another bear hunt next year. It's tomorrow at 1 on Topical Currents. This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.